Blog Talk Radio.
Forget about those Monday blues. It is True Crime Tuesday. Dr. John here from today. It was beautiful, sunny, and 75 degrees in Myrtle Beach. While I know that the folks from Harlan, Kentucky were freezing today. And we're glad to have them on here, Tony and Darla. We've got Robin from the Midlands of South Carolina. Robin, how's the weather over there today?
Oh, it's better today. Much, much better. It's beautiful.
So you got some of that decent weather. All right, that's awesome.
It's supposed to be gone by tomorrow, but...
Uh-oh, what are we going to have tomorrow?
Huh?
What are we going to have tomorrow? More rain?
Rain!
Oh, great. All right, well, we'll just button down the hatches and get ready to go. All right, folks, and we've got Tony and Darla here with us from the murder capital of the world, Harlan, Kentucky. I'm going to turn this one over to Tony Filosi. How you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing just wonderful, John. We have a lot of good information lined up tonight. We are going to cover a little bit more on Edmund Kemper. We actually have came up with some moon phase information, some numerology information that we hadn't seen out there before. And before we get started, I want to give a shout out to Kristen Thompson, who helps quite a bit with the research, and a friend of mine, a co-worker, David McGill. He is EM, Emergency Management Director for Harlan County, and he gave me some insights into Dave's also been a firefighter for many years, and he's given me some insights into structure fires that we'll talk about that I will use later when we talk about the solder children. But now at this point, I want to turn it over to the wonderful, the talented, the beautiful Darla Sadler Jackson, the queen of true crime, always on time.
Hello, happy to be here. Excited about tonight's show. Very excited about the new information that Tony has come up with, and then super excited to get on with our new topic, which will be the Sauter family fire. And Tony, I guess.
Tony has new and exciting information. Yes, Tony was not paying attention. Tony shall pay attention from now on. I was shuffling my papers. I was deep into introspection here.
Always researching. Mm-hmm.
Okay, some of the things that I want to talk about is we want to break down Kemper's crimes or his victims. 80% of Kemper's victims were double murders. 90% were female. Now, the two singles, were they really single murders, or is there someone out there that they've not discovered yet? And this may be where the impasse, Robin and John can help us there, but there's been no more bodies discovered that Kemper has taken credit for. But now we have to realize that Edmund Kemper is a criminal, and obviously a heinous criminal. So he would also be a liar. You know, he's not going to tell everything. I don't think. I think he's telling about 60-70%. I think Edmund Kemper is so smart that he enjoys toying with authorities. I don't think there's just 10 people out there that Kemper killed. Now, does anybody have any thoughts on that? Do we think that the Iko Ku and Cindy Shaw were single victims, or were they
no
part of a
no?
Ah,
I think there's more.
I agree. There has to be more. The only reason he was caught when he was is because he actually turned himself in. Even at that point, it's probable he wouldn't be caught. Many, many serial killers only give up so much information they keep so much secret. We still don't know every victim of Ted Bundy. We have assumed ones. And I think the same with Kemper. I think that we could really match him with a lot of missing women in South Central California during that era.
Now, also from a logistical standpoint, you know, if we were going to take up serial killing as a profession, it would be much easier to kill one person at a time than two people at a time. So why did it, you know, I don't think he would have stopped. His grandmother and grandfather was a double. I don't believe, I'm not buying into the bull hockey that he killed Papaw because that he didn't want him to go through the pain. Well, you know, I think he killed Papaw because he liked to kill two people at a time. And also, now this is something that's really interesting. Taking into account that his youngest victim was 15, and I don't think she was a student. She may have been, but she looked older than what she was. All victims were between 15 and 72 years old. That was between the youngest victim and his grandfather. Now, the co-ed victims, discounting the 15-year-old, were between 18 and 24 years of age. All the co-ed double murders took place between the 5th and the 7th of each month. The number 7 or multiple of it shows up a great deal in the murder dates. Now we get, anybody have anything to say on that? I mean, I find it odd that all the double murders took place between the 5th and the 7th.
That's very strange. There's got to be a correlation of something that's important to him on those dates.
Now, we get into that.
Tony, this is Dr. John. This may sound silly, but I know in retail sales, the first week of the month is always the biggest because a lot of people get paid between the 1st and the 3rd. So it might not necessarily be the payday, but it could be some other factors that would trigger between the 5th and the 7th. I don't know what they might be, but, you know, it
Absolutely.
Could be other factors. I don't know.
Now, let's look at that, John. That's a good point. I think it's the moon phases. All family members were killed during a gibbous moon phase, either waxing or waning. All co-eds were killed during a crescent moon phase, whether waxing or waning. And I think out of that most of them, let me check my notes here.
So he's got to have something to do with the pagan or the paranormal.
That's my thoughts, but I thought you guys, you know, I want to throw this to the impasse, and of course you too, Darla, and see, and what do you make of this? I've not seen anything like this on any of the Kemper documentaries. Now, let's look at the waning gibbons, waning crescent, waxing crescent. Most of them, all of them but one, were waxing crescent as far as the double murders. Now, I'll throw this one more thing out. Kristen brought it to my attention, and then I want you guys' thoughts. Is he killed his mother? Robin, you may know something about numerology. None of us do, and if there's somebody out there that does, maybe you can verify this information. But I'm fairly confident in it because Kristen really does her homework.
Paganism deals with the numerology.
Okay, now, he killed his mother on the 21st, if I'm not mistaken. Killed her on the 19th. He killed her between the 19th and the 21st, which we're thinking it's the 19th. But it was close enough. The 21st is a symbol of success and completion, and that was, you know, if you killed her on the 19th, you know, that's just a couple days from the 21st, which would be, in numerology, a sign of success, completion, fulfillment. What do you think about that?
The number 5 is supposed to be the equivalent of all four elements of the earth, as well as Christianity, and it also is supposed to indicate struggles and conflicts. So if he is as troubled as we seem to think he is, that would have to do with the five. Now, as far as the seventh, trying to find out what the seventh is. Eighth is Sabbath dates. Let me see if I can figure it out. Six is a solar number. I'm trying to find out seven. I can remember it. But all the dates that you're coming up with all have a sign through the pagan, which means he has to be, his spirit actually has to be pagan.
I just found it really unusual that once we got to digging into this about the moon phases and the you don't see a lot about or see anything. You just see in the documentaries, well, he killed two girls on this date, he killed two girls on this date, he killed one girl here, he killed one girl there. But they don't go into he killed
the number
seven.
But the number seven has to do with the lunar energy and the connection to the moon. So that's going to explain why it's all these different moons that he's done it under. It all connects. Again, everything that you're saying connects to the pagan spirituality.
And see, I didn't know that. That's the reason I wanted to throw this out there to you guys and see what you thought. Because... and the number, I just looked it up, the number 19 represents completion in numerology also. So he killed his mother on the 19th, which that signifies completion. You know,
well,
and what
the whole thing also shows he's a much more intelligent human being than people gave him credit for.
Oh,
This is something he had to plot.
Yes.
This is something that took great deal of concentration, great deal of focus.
That's my thoughts. And I think that he in his mind, he's feeding them this line of stuff and just laughing at him going, you know, if I didn't want it to end, it wouldn't have been. It ended because he wanted it to end. He ended it on the 19th, which signifies completion. That's my thoughts. I mean, that's my, especially after seeing this numerology thing. I think that they've gotten, and I know we're not the FBI or the police, and you know, we're none of those folks, but I think they missed this. And you guys can, you know, what are your thoughts? You agree? You disagree?
Oh,
kind of in the middle?
No, I agree. I think, like I said, I think that he was a lot more in depth than anybody ever thought. I don't think that the dates of the murders were random. I think they were planned for those dates, for what
yes,
they symbolized, the fact
right.
that they correlated to different moons. All of that stuff goes back to paganism.
And the two
Which
phases,
also,
he only killed during two phases of the moon.
And all of that goes back, all of that goes back into magic. And magical presences using the earth and the moon and the stars combined.
Darla, what's your thoughts?
I too believe that he was more complex, that his appearance did not lend to people considering his intellect. I have seen his IQ being listed as 135. 146. I think that probably his IQ was actually higher than that.
I agree.
I also wonder if the Zodiac Killer was active in San Francisco area. I'm thinking around that same time. I wonder if somehow he didn't tap into that and started dabbling into that, into the occult. It's really untelling what he was dabbling in at that time.
John, what do you think?
I'll tell you what I really think.
That's going to be a very unpopular thing.
I don't think he was that smart. I think he was a casual dabbler into things. I mean, I know that I've, you know, I know what the zodiac sun signs are, but I'm not a zodiac guy. But I could certainly conjure up some thoughts about it and use that as a guide for something. I think he was fairly smart, but I don't think he was a real. I just don't think he was a real big guy that was all into that. I think it was very superficial, and he may have read a book on numerology and just got it in his head that 19 was completion and 5 and 7 and whatever they are. And, you know, he might have used those superficial names and tags on those numbers to do what he did. And, you know, because a lot of, you know,
I don't like to give people too much credit that killed a lot of people. I mean, you know, they're just crazy. And he could get something in his head and just do it over and over and over. And I'm sorry to buck the trend, but that's the vibe that I get. That he was just a dabbler, and he got these things in his head, and you know, whatever.
But most crazy people are highly intelligent.
Yeah. I respect your opinion, but I think this guy. I think he had it thought out. I think that he was way smarter than they even give him credit for, because the statistical probability of him picking a book up and saying, "Hey, I believe I just whacked these people on this day, and I got to make sure there's a Gibbons moon there. I don't know, man. Anything is possible. That's the reason I wanted to throw it out there and see what everybody thought. So any more thoughts or observations on Edmund Kemper?
I just think, you know, that he's just excessively crazy. And I do agree with John on that part. Even if he does random things, he's a nut job. But a lot of these crazy people don't realize they're crazy, but they're highly intelligent and calculated. You know, they may be off the charts. They may do random things and not, you know, have a whole lot of thought process behind them, but they're too damn smart. That's what makes them so damn dangerous.
And hard to catch. Edmund Kemper, if he had not wanted to complete whatever cycle, we need to look at the number 10, how that plays into anything, because he had 10 victims that we know of. I think he had more. I think he had at least 12, and I think whatever, however many victims that he had, this is a multiple of two that we know of. I think whatever that he had ends in a multiple of two, and I don't know what the number two means in numerology, but that's what I think. But all right, are we good with Kemper? We want to move on to the Stoddard family.
I'm gonna make another statement, and then you can definitely go on. I think he had 21 victims.
I agree with that, because I came up with a much higher number too, and it wasn't 21, but it was very close to it.
I think 10. I do too, man. He's a criminal, so he's not going to tell the truth. I think he's toying with the authorities, but I agree completely. He had more than 10. Darla, what do you think? Do you think he had more than 10 victims?
I do, simply because he wasn't going to get caught. He made himself get caught. He was good enough that he was prolific. He is probably, besides Ted Bundy, the second serial killer that absolutely just loved to kill. He was a killing machine. So absolutely, I think, and if you look at the timeline, it looks as if his murders are very separate, very far apart in twos. I think that there are, in those months, that there's nothing. I think there's lots of things I think he's killing during that time, too.
I don't think he can
stand to take a six-month break. He can't stand to do that. Yes.
Everything.
Okay, I'm going to give one more quick take when you guys get a second.
Okay.
because you know I have to go outside of the box because it's kind of what I do. First, I can 100% agree with John. The number I got was not 21, but it was in the 20s and very close to 21. So I absolutely agree with that 110%.
Apparently, we were listening to the same MindSpeak channel.
Yeah, because I got 24, which is close to 21. So
see, that's a multiple of two. He kills in pairs.
Does he? Okay. Here's what else I got. Take it for whatever it's worth, okay? Because we all know that I tend to go in all different size of boxes. I think that he was very highly into whether it's technically a pagan or not. He really dabbled in the occult. And I think that more so than what people realize, I think he did it very privately. I don't think he was, you know, like right out there with it. But I think he also got playing around in it to the degree. He was already crazy. He was already killing people. That was all him. But when he got into the occult, he had something else get hold of him. So not only you're talking about a man that was already a mass murderer to begin with, and then he gets something attached to him because he kept trying to mess with the occult. I keep seeing him doing various things, and it doesn't even matter what he was doing. But the bottom line was he was dealing with this and the magic thing of the occult, and he had something else come in. So you're talking about one murdering person connecting with another murdering person, and now he's got voices in his head on top of what he was already like by himself. Okay, he was not innocent. He was already killing people when this happened.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got two of them in the same head going off. And that could partially explain the two at a time. And that I just popped into my head at the last minute. But there was definitely another voice talking to him in his head. And that voice came in, though, after he already had thoughts of murdering. I don't know if he had killed yet or not, but he was already primed and ready to go for that. And I think that he already had killed. But when he got into that occult stuff, when he got into calling on other entities, and that they do, and not all occults. I'm not going to say all because that is, I don't know, but I don't believe that part to be true. But whatever he did, he called in other beings, not necessarily beings, other people, and he got hold of somebody. Because
you know, Robin,
when I try to do...
I was going to say, it's interesting because a lot of people inadvertently call in things that they shouldn't out of desperation.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. And then we don't know if it worked or whatever. And I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying, but a lot of people do it and they don't know if it's going to work. They're in a fantasy world, but lo and behold, it works. Oh my goodness. And they're
You know, they think it's something that's going to be funny, and it's real funny until something actually comes in and people end up dead. Or they get things attached to them. And I've been contacted by more than one person that's had that happen.
Yeah.
And it actually does. And I think that, you know, at some point, I keep seeing a vision of him, and he's standing in front of this giant bonfire. And the bonfire's got like a teepee built in it, and the flames are underneath of it. And he's in there, and he's calling on something that he thinks is going to help him with these murders. And I think he actually got it. And I've been getting that since we got on air, and it doesn't seem to be going away. It just seems very consistent, and it gets stronger every time I get that vision. And he's calling on something. Now, I don't know if he's thinking when he does this, he's sacrificing something to the gods or whatever.
That would be that's my thought. He sacrificed.
Yeah,
he's
absolutely doing it. And I feel like this has to do with the moons. Because when he's doing it, this is at night. He's out in the woods. He's by himself. And he's calling on something. And I can't make out what the heck he's calling. But he's calling on something, and he's talking to it. And it's just the teepee in the middle of this bonfire is taller than he is, or as tall. And there's just huge flames under, and he's talking to it. And he's calling on something. I mean, this is, for all of his intelligence, for all of that, he is very deeply disturbed. And he's calling on these things to help him. And I believe that that's exactly what he got was something else. Because then when I go and I try to get inside his head, you know, you have people that have multiple personalities or whatever, hear voices. And that, from my perspective, when I zoom in on somebody that has that problem, it looks and feels a certain way. When you have a person that has another entity that's also involved too, that feels and looks a different way. So, it, you know, for me, it's easy to tell those two apart. This is two separate individuals, and he's talking to it, and it's talking to him in his head. And I think that he got into something, and he was already disturbed, he was already dangerous, he was already killing, and he got involved in some kind of culture, spirituality, whatever you want to call it, you know, because I don't want to call out any certain groups because they're not all bad. There's some very good people in a lot of these groups. But what he did was he called on something, whether it be what he considered a god or whatever, and he got it. And this thing was even more violent than he was.
Wow.
And that could be part of the whole two things, because one killing was for him, one killing was for the other.
And we'll look into that. We will look into ritualistic killings.
It has a lot to do with
that.
It really does have a lot, so I think you'll find some answers.
Okay. Well, all right. If we're all done with, and I think this was a really good wrap-up for Edmund Kemper, guys. I mean, everybody did a great job. But if we're done with Edmund Kemper, let's move on to the Sauter children. Dara, do you have a recap of the Sauter children disappearance?
I absolutely do. This is pretty lengthy because there is so much involved with this. I have condensed this as much as possible. So for anyone who has never heard of the Sauter family fire, this is a notorious mystery of West Virginia. And I'm going to give a history of exactly what happened. For nearly four decades, anyone driving down Route 16 near Fayetteville, West Virginia, could see a billboard bearing the grainy images of five children, all dark-haired and solemn-eyed, and their names and ages. Maurice, 14, Martha, 12, Louis, 9, Jenny, 8, Betty, 5, stenciled beneath along with a speculation about what happened to them. Fayetteville was and is a small town with a main street that doesn't run more than 100 yards, and rumors always played a larger role in the case than evidence. No one even agreed on whether the children were dead or alive. What everyone knew for certain was this. On the night before Christmas, 1945, George and Jenny Sauter and nine of their 10 children went to sleep. One son was away in the Army. Around 1 a.m., a fire broke out. George and Jenny and four of their children escaped, but the other five were never seen again. George had tried to save them, breaking a window to re-enter the house, slicing skin on his arm. He could see nothing through the smoke and fire, which had swept through all of the downstairs rooms, living room, dining room, kitchen, office, and his and Jenny's bedroom. He took frantic stock of what he knew. Two-year-old Sylvia, whose crib was in their bedroom, was safe outside, as was 17-year-old Marion and two sons, 23-year-old John and 16-year-old George Jr., who had fled the upstairs bedroom that they shared, singeing their hair on the way out, actually. He figured Maurice, Martha, Louis, Jenny, and Betty still had to be upstairs, cowering in two bedrooms on either end of the hallway, separated by a staircase that was now engulfed in flames. He raced back outside, hoping to reach them through the upstairs window, but the ladder he always kept propped against the house was strangely missing. An idea struck. He would drive one of his two coal trucks up to the house, climb atop it to reach the window. But even though they'd functioned perfectly the day before, neither would start now. He ransacked his mind for another option. He tried to swoop water from a rain barrel, but found that it had frozen solid. 5 of his children were stuck somewhere inside those great whipping ropes of smoke. He didn't notice that his arm was slick with blood and that his voice hurt from screaming their names. His daughter Marion sprinted to a neighbor's home to call the Fayetteville Fire Department but couldn't get an operator response. A neighbor who saw the blaze made a call from a nearby cavern, but again, no operator responded. Exasperated, the neighbor drove into town and tracked down the fire chief, F.J. Morris, who initiated Fayetteville's version of a fire alarm, a phone tree system whereby one firefighter phoned another, who phoned another. The fire department was only 2.5 miles away, but the crew did not arrive until 8 a.m., by which point the Sauter's home had been reduced to a smoking pile of ash. George and Jeannie assumed that 5 children were dead, but a brief search of the grounds on Christmas Day turned up no trace of remains. Chief Morris suggested that the blaze had been hot enough to completely cremate the bodies. A state police inspector combed the rubble and attributed the fire to faulty wiring. George covered the basement with 5 feet of dirt, intending to preserve the site as a memorial. The coroner's office issued 5 death certificates just before the new year, attributing the cause to fire or suffocation. But the Sauters had begun to wonder if their children were still alive. George Sauter was born in Giorgio Sadu in Tula, Sardinia in 1895 and immigrated to the United States in 1908 when he was only 13 years old. An older brother who had gone with him to Ellis Island immediately returned to Italy, leaving George on his own. He found work on Pennsylvania railroads, carrying water supplies to laborers. After a few years, he moved to Smithers, West Virginia. Smart and ambitious, he worked first as a driver and then launched his own trucking company, hauling dirt and then later coal. One day, he walked into a local store, and that is where he met the owner's daughter, Jenny Cipriani, who had come over from Italy when she was 3 years old. They married and had 10 children and settled in Fayetteville, West Virginia, that was a small but active Italian immigrant community. The Sauters were said by one county magistrate, one of the most respected middle-class families around. George had strong opinions about everything from business to current events and politics, but was for some reason reticent to talk about his youth. He never explained what happened back in Italy to make him want to leave. The Sauters planted families across the space where their house had stood and began to stitch together a series of odd moments that led up to the fire. There was a stranger who appeared at the home a few months earlier, back in the fall, asking about hauling work. He meandered to the back of the house, pointed to 2 separate fuse boxes, and said, "This is going to cause a fire someday." Strange, George thought, especially since he had just been, the wiring had just been checked by a local power company, which pronounced it in fine condition. Around the same time, another man tried to sell the family life insurance and became irate when George declined. "Your goddamn house is going to go up in smoke," he said, "and your children are going to be destroyed. You are going to be paid for your dirty remarks you have made about Mussolini." George was indeed outspoken about his dislike for this this Italian dictator, and he occasionally engaged in heated arguments with other members of Fayetteville's Italian community. At the time, no one took the threat seriously. The older Sauter sons also recalled something peculiar. Just before Christmas, they noticed a man parking along U.S. Highway 21 intently watching the younger kids as they walked home from school. About 12:30 a.m. Christmas morning, after the children had opened a few presents and everyone had gone to sleep, the shrill ring of a telephone broke the quiet. Jenny rushed to answer it. An unfamiliar female voice asked for an unfamiliar name. There was raucous laughter and glasses clinking in the background. Jenny told her, "You have the wrong number," and hung up. She tiptoed back to bed, But as she did, she noticed all of the downstairs lights were on and the curtains open. The front door was unlocked. She saw Marion, the 17-year-old daughter, asleep on the sofa in the living room and assumed that the other kids had gone upstairs to bed. She turned out the lights, closed the curtains, locked the door, and returned to her room. She had just begun to doze off when she heard one sharp, loud bang on the roof and then something rolling down the roof. An hour later, she was roused once again, this time by heavy smoke curling into her room. Jenny couldn't understand how five children could perish in a fire and leave no bones, no flesh, nothing. She conducted private experiments burning animal bones, chicken bones, beef, pork, anything she could get her hands on, and each time she was left with a heap of charred bones. She knew that remnants of various household appliances had been found in the burned-out basement, but still, there were no remains identifiable of her children. An employee at a crematorium informed her that bones remain after bodies are burnt for several hours at 2,000 degrees. Their house was destroyed in less than 45 minutes. The collection of odd moments grew. A telephone repairman told the Sodders that their lines had been cut, not burned. Then he realized that if the fire had been electrical, the result of faulty wiring, as the official report stated, why did the power remain on as the house burned to the point that as it grew in flames, the Christmas tree still lit up? Another question is, why did George's trucks refuse to start? One day, while the family was visiting the site, Sylvia found a hard rubber object in the yard. This was identified and concluded that it was a napalm pineapple bomb and was suspected to be what had rolled off the roof the night of the fire. Then came the reports of the sightings. A woman claimed to have seen the missing children peering from a passing car while the fire was in progress. A woman operating a tourist stop between Fayetteville and Charleston, West Virginia, some 50 miles west, said she saw the children the morning after the fire. She said she served them breakfast. She actually told the police this. There was a car with a Florida license plate at the tourist court, too. A woman at a Charleston hotel saw the children's photo in the newspaper and said she had seen four of the five after the fire. They were accompanied by two women and two men, all of Italian extraction, she said in the statement to the police. I do not remember the exact date. However, the entire party did register at the hotel and stayed in a large room with several beds. They registered about midnight. I tried to talk to the children in a friendly manner, but the men appeared hostile and refused to allow me to speak to the children. In 1947, this is 2 years later, George and Jenny sent a letter to the FBI in which they said they wished they could help, but said that was up to the local Fayetteville police and authorities. Next, the Sodders turned to a private investigator, C.C. Tinsley, who discovered that the insurance salesman who had threatened George was a member of the coroner's jury that deemed the fire accidental. So heard a curious story from a Fayetteville minister about F.J. Morris, the fire chief. Although Morris had claimed no remains were found, he supposedly confided that he discovered a heart in the ashes and hid it inside a dynamite box and buried it at the scene. Tinsley persuaded Morris to show them the spot. Together, they dug up the box and took it straight to a local funeral director who concluded that it was beef liver and had never been touched by a fire. Soon after, the Sodders heard rumors that the fire chief had told others that the contents of the box had not been found in the fire at all, that he had buried the beef liver in the rubble in hope that finding any remains would placate the family and make them stop the investigation. Over the next few years, the tips and leads continued to come. George saw a newspaper photo of school children in New York City and was convinced that one of them was his daughter, Betty. He drove to Manhattan in search of the child, but her parents refused to let George speak or see the child. In August 1949, the Sodders decided to mount a new search at the fire scene and brought in a pathologist from the Smithsonian. He discovered vertebra through the shards of rubble and dirt. The Smithsonian concluded that it is very strange that no other bones were found at the evacuation site. None of the bones were burned, and they belonged to young adults much older than the children. In 1968, more than 20 years after the fire, Jenny went to get the mail and found an envelope addressed only to her. It was postmarked in Kentucky, but had no return address. Inside was a photo of a man in his mid-20s. On its flip side, a cryptic handwritten note read, "Louis Sodder, I love brother Frankie, little boys, A90132 or 35. She and George couldn't deny the resemblance to their Louis, who was 9 years old at the time of the fire. Beyond obvious similarities, dark curly hair, dark brown eyes, they had the same straight nose and the same upward tilt of the left eyebrow. Once again, they hired a private detective, sent him to Kentucky, and they never seen or heard from him ever again. The Sodders fear if they published the letter or the name that it would perhaps somehow cause Louis harm. They simply put the photo on the billboard underneath Louis's 9-year-old picture. Since the fire had worn black exclusively, a sign mourning, and sign of mourning, and continued to do so until her own death in 1989. The billboard finally came down. Her children and grandchildren continued to investigate and came up with theories of their own. The local mafia had tried to recruit George, and he declined. They tried to extort money from him, and he refused. The children were kidnapped by someone they knew, someone who burst into the unlocked door, told them about the fire, and offered to take them someplace safe. They might not have survived the night. If they had, and if they lived for decades, it really was Louis in that photograph. They failed to contact any of their parents only because they wanted to protect them. One other thing that I have just recently discovered before I wrote this up is that nuns in a convent and school for girls claimed that Martha, the oldest child, had been a student there for several years, and she had gone by, I think, the name Cynthia. And so that is basically the open-ended story and mystery of the Sodder family. Tony, I'll let you reflect on this.
Well, I have a lot of questions about how the investigation was handled and the narrative that they gave at the time. Let's start with the Jenny Sodder hearing these bumps. Okay, let's talk about the ladder. The ladder was later found 75 feet or so, I think, from the house down a little bank. I think it was, and you had two gentlemen, Lonnie Johnson and David Atkins, and I wish I'd written my source down, that admitted to cutting the wires. One went to the Army and one was fined a small fee. Now, they were supposed to be there stealing. There were several thefts in the area. They were stealing block and tackle or something from one of the trucks or from Mr. Sodder. I think the bump that she heard was the ladder going against or being pulled down from the house. Now, my question is, why the two thieves that are after block and tackle cut a telephone line? Why are you going to waste that time? Why are you going to, back in the day, and anybody that, you know, lives in Appalachia, you know, if you hear something bumping against your house, you know, you may call 911 before you go out, but you're going out and you're going out armed in case somebody's stealing something, in case, you know, they're trying to, you know. So I'm not really buying into they cut it because they didn't want them to report the fire. They wanted the house to burn as I think is a distraction. The fireball or bomb, if it had truly been a firebomb, you know, they say it was made out of hard plastic. It would have melted. You know, if it had been on fire, it'd start a fire. It would have melted or showed some signs of severe heat. So I got problems with that. The bus driver that drove by and said he saw people flinging flaming objects on the house. Okay, Darla, John, Robin, if you're going by your neighbor's house and you see something like that, are you just going to go, crap, they're throwing flammable objects on Tony's roof? Or are you going to stop and blow your horn or try to call, or what are you going to do?
Exactly.
It kind of depends on who's throwing, and if you're afraid of them, you'll pass on by.
I was getting ready to say the same thing. Fear.
But if you got,
I agree with John.
But when you got to the next house, you're going to stop and call. You know.
I have my own theory on why nobody contacted them, nobody called, nothing. But we'll wait till the end. But. Yeah, they would not have. I mean, normally any normal sane person would, but for the reasons if I'm right, and I doesn't mean I am,
right,
then in that case, no, they wouldn't have.
Tony was talking about the fire lines, the phone lines being cut prior to the fire. I've always wondered, speculated. It doesn't seem to me that the prank phone call was, or the wrong number was, just a weird coincidence. I think someone attempted to cut the line, went to the local tavern because they could hear a lot going on. There was a local bar just down the street. Someone drove, had a lady at the bar call. She acted like it was a wrong number. So they made a successful attempt at cutting those lines.
Now, the bumps on the side of the house, were they before the phone call or after the phone call?
After. As she was dozing off, dozing back off from answering the phone, she claims to hear a thud and a roll on the roof.
Okay, I think that was a ladder, and I think that was them cutting the phone lines. Why do you know? Then we go get into why the two thieves, two nickel dime thieves, bother cutting the phone. They're not cutting it because they're stealing a few tools.
No, they got paid to do it. They got paid by the Italians. They were just a bunch of 2-bit thugs, and they got used.
Right. So something was going on. Now let's go back to the fire. Okay, they say that. The fire started, the throwing this stuff on the roof. So we're imagining that the fire is going to start, if it's a flammable substance, the fire is going to start somewhere on the roof area and maybe stream down the side of the house, maybe. Now, I was talking to David McGill, the emergency management director, who's also been a firefighter for well over a decade. And he's also an arson investigator, if I'm not mistaken. Now, let's think about this. Okay, the Sauter children are supposed to be in the room, in the level above mom and dad, right? In the attic area. Is that correct?
They call it the attic. It is an upstairs area with a bedroom, two bedrooms, one on each side of the stairs.
And I've seen some photos but I can't be sure they're the real photos of the slaughterhouse. But are there windows there? The one I'm seeing, there's a few windows.
Yes, there are. But from the photos I've seen, there are windows. Yes.
Yes. Okay. So this these two dudes, and they start the fire. It's on the roof. Now you're not going to get. This is the reason I don't think this fire started on the roof, but we'll get into that. But we'll say the fire started on the roof. You're not going to have smoke in the house for a long time, very little, until it burns through and and the structure starts crashing down on itself. Something, so the part of the ceiling of the roof comes down into the home. That's when you're going to have, some more ignition and some more smoke. Okay, if it's on top of the house, it's going to take a little bit before you get a lot of smoke. And I don't think, and the reason I'm making a point of the smoke is, if the children were above them, if they weren't unconscious from smoke, they would have heard all this commotion and came down. Now, my second thing is, if they're right up above them, and I'm going to throw this out to all of you, okay, if you don't have children, you probably have nieces, nephews, or, someone like that. So as an adult, we had the smoke coming under the door. We open it, house is filling up with smoke. The kids are above us. Just a few, 15 seconds, not even that long, 10 seconds from you. They say George Sauter assumed all his kids was outside. Are we really going to assume that? Are we going to jet up there and look in the room, okay, everybody's, out of the house?
Exactly.
You're talking about five children. I mean, y'all give me your thoughts on that. I mean, would you really run out of the damn house? And not check on your kids? Nobody would. Nobody would.
I would be going through every nook and cranny of that house.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Darla, you agree?
I have mixed emotions. I can't help but wonder if perhaps there were so many children. Just keep in mind, now there are 9 or 10 children in this house at that time. It's chaos. They see several of the older ones. They've grabbed the baby. It's possible that they assumed and then discovered when they got out that not all their children are there. Or there's always the theory that George behaved innocent. He did behave innocent, but he was always convinced his children were alive, extremely convinced.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have mixed emotions about George. I think he acted innocent.
That's my gut.
Maybe had some knowledge.
He was involved.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be an inside job. Now, another question is, and I know we could never find the answer, but what do you think about if somebody else had taken out? The insurance guy came, dad didn't want to take out insurance, somebody else takes out insurance. Was any insurances ever paid out? Did that guy ever, I would like to, and I know we can't, we'll never be able to go back and find that out. But that, I found that awfully suspicious, about the insurance guy.
The three people, the two men in the car, we don't know what they were doing, but we do know they were watching the children. And then for two different men to state that house was going to burn, and one even going as far as saying your house is going to burn and your children are going to be destroyed, I think that's very suspicious.
Now, did he verify those? Is that who gave that statement, George Sauter?
George Sauter gave that statement. Older children gave the watching, the men watching the house, but George Sauter gave the two statements that the two men made about his home going to be burned.
Now, we can say that that's really true, or we can say that's a convenient story that George saw, because I'm not convinced that Sawyer wasn't involved. I'm not convinced that maybe one of the children, you told me about one of the older children sleeping downstairs and all the mm-hmm. lights are on and the door's unlocked, conveniently. So George Sauter comes up with this, and, you know, maybe some of the children were witnesses to it. I don't know. But
I believe
if they were
involved.
If not, then all we have is George Sauter's word, conveniently, that these dudes said my house is going to burn. Okay, again, he's in West Virginia. He's from Italy, too. So he's going to be – he's already hot-tempered about politics, right?
Yeah.
And when somebody tells you that, when Joe Bob or Billy Bob tells you that, Robin, you're living in the South, and John, you live in Olive's live in the South. So, if somebody tells you that, and then your house burns, and five of your children are gone, what's going to happen to the two dudes that told you that? Especially not.
Well, they're going to go after them.
Yeah.
This is this thing is much more in depth than what.
Somebody's going to tell you something, because you're going to go find them. You or some of your friends are going to go find them. And I know the right way to do would be the law to handle it. I'm just talking about as you just lost five children.
Mm-hmm.
These guys said your house are going to burn, your children are going to disappear. Who's the first SOB you're going to?
Yeah, the one that said it.
Yeah, hell yeah. Did he ever make a statement? Exactly. Darla, did you find any information where they pulled those dudes, those fellas into question?
I have not found any information regarding that. I'm thinking that the man who asked for a job was never seen again. He was seen by other family members. He did truly arrive at the home. One other thing that George did that I found suspicious, and I'm not 100% thinking George did it. I don't know either way, but one thing that always just didn't make sense to me is that within days of that fire, he covered it with dirt. He absolutely
made a memorial.
He made a memorial, but he also
kids that he already knew were alive, because he were the reason they were gone. He knew they were going to be taken. He set it up that way.
Since we're talking about this aspect, the bones that were found were actually from the fill dirt and not from the fire. It was determined that they were either European settlers or Native American, that somehow they had dug into an unmarked grave site to fill that. So those bones were not, they were young adults, and they were not associated with the fire.
Okay, now let's talk. Now we hit on the bones real quickly. I spoke to David. He's unfortunately been involved in several body recoveries from fires. He said that there's no way that for that fire burning 45 minutes to an hour at around 1500 degrees or so is going to obliterate the bones. Now, Darla, you also, some of the listeners may or may not know, one of your businesses is a funeral home, and you do have people cremated from time to time.
Yeah.
When you send them to the crematorium, what happens? How long do they have to stay?
At least a body to be cremated has to be in the incinerator at least 2 hours for at least 2,000 degrees, and that does not reduce a body to ashes at that point, there has to be other means
employed.
Pulverize, yes, to create that very ash look. It is absolutely, there is no way five bodies can be undetected in the ash. No, that is impossible.
That was my next thing. I'm going to throw that out there, and then y'all chime in. We have five bodies that were burned, allegedly, for around an hour. At less than the temperature that it takes to cremate, you have appliances and other things that weren't badly damaged. Or they were scorched, I'm sure, in the wire and burn, but not obliterated. You know? How do you explain that? There's nothing. There's no evidence of any bodies whatsoever. What do y'all think?
John.
Yeah, I've got a question, and I haven't heard anybody talk about this. Who's the sheriff?
Oh, we don't know his name, but we're getting to the botched. Do you remember his name, Darla?
Was Morris the coroner or the sheriff? I think his last name was Moore. I think it was Sheriff Morris.
Yeah.
Here's my point. It doesn't sound very botched to me. It sounds like it just simply wasn't done. Because the first thing is, if you're a sheriff, and the guy says, I can't find five of my children. Well, okay, either they're burnt up or they're around somewhere. So why isn't there, even in the mid-40s, they could put out an all-points bulletin to look for five kids. And it seems like nothing was done on purpose. Now, that's what I think.
I agree. Absolutely. 100%.
And this is not being intuitive. This is just saying, you know, a fairly logical progression of what happens. Okay, I can't find five of my kids. Well, they've either been burned or they've run away or something happened to them. So let's put out an APB. That didn't take very long because they had shortwave radios back then, and that's what they used. I mean, that could have been done in 1 minute, and you know, a decently trained, not even a well trained. But a decently trained sheriff would immediately get an APB set up. So first of all, you look at the sheriff and you say, well, is this sheriff involved? Probably. I'm sorry.
The fire chief planted a heart at the scene. Mm-hmm. There was a
because
heart
he
planted at the scene.
In a biscuit tin.
Yes.
And the sheriff, he did not.
He was under control.
He had to be because the police work that he did was absolutely zilch.
Yeah, he was under control by the same people that paid off the two guys that cut the line, the same people that took the kids. There's a huge thing going on.
Whenever they arrested the two guys that cut the line, he made sure that
they were fall guys.
Well, one went to the Army, and then one went got like a small fine. They owned a beer store or something. So he did everything that he could to hamper and impede and make sure that a legitimate investigation didn't take place. Now, Darla, if I'm not mistaken, did the FBI offer their help at one point, and then he turned them down?
At one point, years later, it seems as if he turned them down at first, and then a couple years later, they asked for their help, and they were declined. But, of course, this was years later. The scene had been destroyed at that point.
Well, I would like to explain to everybody the care a reasonable sheriff would take. This is the story of Liston Truesdale. And he was the sheriff of Lee County during the Lizard Man episode from 1988 to 1989. Now, when he gets the first complaint about a lizard man sighting, here's what his thought process is, and it sounds like he's a pretty good lawman. He says, "You know what? This is crazy. I don't believe it. But oh my goodness, what if there really is something out there? I don't know everything in Skateboard Swamp. And if somebody gets killed, or if a kid goes missing or whatever, they're going to have my hide." And that's the way a lawman thinks. And in general, I don't think you get to be a sheriff unless you have fairly reasonable skills. Tony and Darla, I mean, you know, up in Harlan County, y'all know the sheriff. Whoever the sheriffs have been, haven't they been reasonably competent people?
Sure, yeah. And that's part of the point that we're going to make as we go on down with the sequence of events is the sheriff, he was either severely incompetent or he was in on it. No question. The fire, now let's go. The fires happened. The kids are missing. How long, Darla, does it take for them to respond?
It takes hours. It's morning before anyone comes. And one other interesting fact, there's so many weird things about this. It's bizarre. Jenny Sauter's brother is on the fire department, and even he did not arrive till that morning. The fire started at 1 a.m. Nothing happened as far as no officials showed up until 8 a.m.
And then, like the fire officials, and we'll get back to the sheriff. You know, whenever the fire chief, basically makes a false statement. Actually, to destroy it, he holds back evidence, and a possible evidence. It turns out to be a beef liver or beef something, with under the. Auspice of, I wanted him to think all the children died. I mean, you got soft tissue that would have burned up. There showed no signs of being burned. You know, why does this guy go through that when it's not even a real human part? I mean, I think that the fire chief and the sheriff both are helping to facilitate this event.
Well, Tony, here's what I would ask you and Darla and your research team to do. I would ask you to put a list to write down a list of all of the major players in that town: the fire chief, the police chief, the insurance guy, anybody that had a connection with this event, and see if there's
already
a common bond.
Already happening.
And so, was there a common bond? Like, were they members of the Ku Klux Klan?
It's too far back. You're not going to get that. But we're making a list of the major players, and we're starting to try to look on different things to see if they were related or if this or that. But where it happened in 1945, you're not going to be able to go back and, unless you go to that town and look up and go to the courthouse, and there's some records that puts them all in the same kind of category. But they, I think it's where the one's a fire chief and one's a law enforcement. They had a lot of interaction anyways.
Well,
you know, they had a lot of interaction.
There was one group that controlled everything. Okay, if you're looking at a bunch of Italians that are there, it's very common when there's a bunch of Italians there that there's, and not anything against Italians, so don't anybody take it that way. But I think you're looking at, even back then, they had mafia. And I think that George had connections in it. I don't necessarily believe that it was money he owed them, but they had something over him, and that's what the whole catalyst was. The ones that were shooting out their mouth at him and everything, they may have had a little bit to do with it, but there was an underground group of them. There was a mafia type, and that's where this whole thing came from. Those kids never died. Those kids got placed all over the place. They never died. And George knew darn well that they were going to be taken. That's why they were upstairs and some kids were downstairs.
Now,
well, okay,
also,
Tony, I've got one. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I've got one more potential place for you guys to look, and that is the Masonic Lodge, because I know that the great UFO crash of 1897 in Aurora, Texas, they recorded everything back in those days in kind of a logbook that happened, because those were, in general, the majority of the influential men in the town. And you might want to talk to someone at the Masonic Lodge and ask them if they recorded any history, or in general, they're not so bad about giving you the member names. They're, you know, frankly, quite proud of their members. So Scottish Rite, Masons, Shriners, whatever organization was there, you could call them and say you're doing some history research and ask them, give them the names, because I have done this, and it worked. It worked in Lugoff, South Carolina, that I was able to get information on people that were around during Lizard Man. I mean, I learned this from actually just reading, I forget whose book it was, but that, you know, they said that the Masonic Lodge was a lot of help even today, and they have been. So that's just a helpful hint from a guy that has done a little bit of history. Okay.
Right. Well, being a 32nd degree Mason, I probably would know a little bit about it. So
look at you. You're the man.
Look at me.
My grandfather. My grandfather was a 32nd degree Mason.
Yeah. So
that's cool.
But we'll definitely look at that that angle. But now another thing that I have a question on is the insurance salesman. Who put the insurance salesman on the coroner's jury? Does anybody know who seats the coroner's jury?
No, but I think you're talking about an organization, if I'm right, and who knows, I might not be, but if I'm right, you're talking about an organization that has very long tentacles. They can control the police. They can control the insurance people. They can control everybody. And these clients that they had cut the wire, they were just a couple of fall guys. That's all they were. They're not going to have their people go in on the front line where they can get picked up right away. They're going to pay off some stupid idiots to go in and do things that if anybody's going to get busted, they're going to get busted. Now, you're talking about a cop not doing his job, a morgue not doing your job, insurance company not doing your job. You're talking about something that has to be not just one or two people, a large organization with clout that can hurt people. I agree with John, 110%, that when they went by and they saw these flames being tossed on the roof or whatever, they did nothing. Because if I'm right, at that time, people were aware that group was there. And they kept their mouth shut to keep themselves alive.
Why did he tell the story?
They've told stories that weren't true.
If he told the story, I mean, if he was that afraid of them, why did he come out later and say, hey, I saw this?
Because he couldn't pinpoint anybody, and he probably had a guilty conscience. You can go out and say, I saw somebody, but if you can't give a description, if you can't give a name, you're not in any danger.
Right.
It's hearsay. Way back then, and it was a different time by then. That night,
they'd already gotten kids.
I mean, the threat to them being hurt was no longer there. So to alleviate their own guilty conscience, they said, well, this is what we did see. Don't know who it was, you know, but that's what we saw. But at the time, they couldn't speak. This whole thing was, if I'm right at all, then this whole thing was orchestrated. And George was aware of it. He wasn't happy about it, but he was aware of it because they had something on him.
But now... Now that we're all in agreement that this George story is not adding up. Now,
right.
Do we think the mob had something to do with it? What would they have to gain with five children? See, that's now this is where it gets kind of muddled. Okay, they take five children,
and they sold them.
Say they take them, they take them out of the country, or they sell them. But
they sell them because George owed money.
Couldn't they have gotten away at some point unless they got their youth out of them?
If they were telling the kids that but what if they told the kids, if you try to leave, we'll kill your parents?
That's exactly what they did.
Absolutely, 100%.
When they get up, 18, 20, 22, 25. You know, what's their thought process then? They just said, well, they think we're dead. We started another life.
No.
You know,
these people kept in contact with them and kept reminding them, all you do is come forward and your parents are dead. Your other siblings are dead. You're talking about a mob, whether it's the mob, mafia, whatever. I mean, they have long tentacles, and they don't go away.
And it's about money.
Okay.
It's all about money with the mob.
It is. So George had to hold them money, and since he couldn't pay him back the money, they got the kids and they sold the kids.
Now, how does he owe them money? Do you think it's because of the trucks that he got? Do you think that he borrowed money there? How did he get into, from all account purposes, he worked his way up. He had no affiliation with anybody,
what did he
and
do
then
for
all
a living?
Of a sudden this happens. Trucks.
Okay, go back to what did he do for a living?
He owned coal trucks. He had a trucking company.
Yes.
He had two trucks.
Yes.
Right, and
so
that's where he got the money.
He's right
and
in the middle of
exactly.
the mob right there. He's
yeah,
right in the
I mean,
of
they
mob.
Are heavy into the trucking companies. I mean,
that,
the mob
that
owns...
In the coal industry or in the dirt industry in that little town, I can tell you from being in trucks for forever, that, you know, you're talking about Teamsters type stuff. You're talking about Jimmy Hoffa type stuff. You're talking about somebody
you're
big.
You're talking about the mob.
Big. Yeah, but this guy had two trucks. Yeah,
it doesn't
now,
matter.
We have to dig a little deeper. I would like to see where he got the money for the two trucks.
Well, yeah, not only that, but, I mean, you're talking, the mob has their hands in every trucking company there was for many, many years. You know, I mean, that Teamsters or not, they're involved in all that. And to start a trucking company takes megabucks. Whether he borrowed the money to start the company, and then I'm sure they gave him the money to start the company, and then on top of that, he also had to help deliver things with those trucks that he probably shouldn't have been delivering because he was tied in with the mob. But eventually they want the money back.
That's exactly right. And when they want it back, they want it back. They're not waiting.
What do you think, Bart? Do you think the mob? Or you think just? I mean, we're down to the point of there's no bodies. There's no.
Nope.
No.
Well, last week, right as we got on, and, you know, nobody has to believe me, that's okay, but I'm just going to put this out there. When we got done with the show last week and you brought this up and you said this is what we're going to do, you know, in these Stoddard children next week, the second you said it, it was like this scenario that just went through my head. Now, I didn't know any information about it until tonight, till Darla started talking about it. And the whole time she's talking about it, backed up everything I got. Okay? So if I'm already picking up stuff on it, John's already picking up stuff on it, you guys already have inclinations on it, and I haven't heard any of this, and then all of a sudden she talks and it backs up every single thing that I've gotten, to me that says we're all on to something. And it makes sense.
I think George Sauter he knew something.
Oh, of course.
Because here's the reason that I think George Sauter and there might have been another family member in on it, but for sure, George Sauter, is, why did he not go to the person that told him that, hey, your house is going to burn, and the insurance salesman says, you know, we're going to get you back to what you said about Mussolini and your blah, blah, blah. Your, what was it the insurance salesman said, Darnell?
He said, when George denied the insurance, he said, well, he said, your house is going to go up in flames. He said, and your children are going to be destroyed.
Okay, now, was this guy really an insurance salesman, do you think? I mean, that's something, that's a question we could, but see, we don't know his name, though, do we?
I'm going to say he was because he was on the committee to.
There you go.
So, yes. And usually insurance people are because they have knowledge of fire and fire damage and all that. So I'm going to say he was.
Okay, coroner's jury. He sat on the coroner's jury.
Yes.
Okay. So, but I mean, why was this guy, and see, this goes back to, I mean, there's something I think that the sheriff knew, Sauter knew, the fire chief knew. I mean, this was a conspiracy. I don't think this is just some mystery that, you know, these kids just, you know, A, if they're dead, they're going to be, you're going to find them in the fire. B, if they had walked out of the house, I mean, there's windows upstairs. You got one of the children, 14, was one of the young men, 14 years old?
Yes, 14, yes.
Okay, so if you have windows, you can raise the windows up and start getting your siblings out. So you're either A, you're all unconscious, and you're burned alive, which would never be bothered.
Or you're gone.
Or you're gone. You're not there. I mean, that's my thing, and I'm leaning toward they weren't there. They didn't die in the fire. They weren't there. And we can speculate it was the mob, it was this, it was that. Whomever it was had to be really connected and powerful to and so Sauter had to be into something that's some really connected up people